Now here we go.
Most people really don't believe me. I know that. I live with that every day of my life. I've been pretty well tuned out by the media. If anything is remembered of me, I guess in the general world, what they remember is, haha, rectal probe, or he's a disturbed man, he's crazy, or something like that. But the truth is, I am not crazy. This is about emotions and feelings more powerful than human beings experience. It's about living and facing such experiences, and it is hard. It is real hard.
Bad things have happened to people from my childhood who I returned to meet again. I think I was traumatized in early childhood, and I don't think I'm real alone. I think the whole neighborhood was bruised as if an invisible fist had come.
And also, I want to go home. I can't get that face out of my head.
I had a really negative dissociation experience recently in Taekwondo. We were doing this basically jumping up and down in our kicking stance. And we were doing it for minutes on end. And somehow I decided it would be a good idea to escape the pain by going out of my body. And it worked, and I was really happy with myself. I was like, oh yeah, this is great. But by the end of the workout, I was like physically ill. I had like a cold sweat, and I actually started to get tunnel vision, and my hearing started to sort of collapse, and I had to sit down.
How did you do it? How did you dissociate?
I just sort of imagined myself like higher, you know, like on the ceiling, sort of.
Looking
just,
down.
Yeah, and just like went out of my body, and to escape that pain. But I mean, it fucking kicked me in the ass.
Afterwards.
Like immediately, virtually immediately.
Have you done that before?
No, and I will never do it again.
do you think, I mean, when you say, you answered very quickly there, like you haven't done it, you don't remember having done it before.
Oh, no, I mean, I haven't done it, you know, in Taekwondo.
What about in other circumstances?
Probably have, yeah. Otherwise, I don't think it would have been so easy.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. But as far as you know, that's the only time you've done it, like, consciously and deliberately.
Yeah, recently, that I can recall.
Well, that's funny, because I was doing yoga just yesterday, also the day before, yesterday morning, and there was a pose at the end with the arms over my head, and they put sandbags on my hands so that my arms would be down on the floor, so I'd be experiencing the full stretch, and it was kind of evoke thoughts of being tortured, and then so then I started imagining what it would be like to be tortured, like you see in the movies and like Jesus, and actually to be, you know, strung up in such a way, an excruciatingly uncomfortable position that you couldn't get out of. How that would be mentally, like the feeling of being trapped in discomfort, physical discomfort, and how you would deal with that mentally, because it would be like, I was imagining anyway, it'd be like going insane, like, because there would be nowhere to go, there'd be nowhere to flee to, right? Your body is your body, that's it, that's your reality, you can't leave your body. But I guess the answer is, the point is that you can. But
yeah.
There is it. There are methods and techniques for leaving the body.
Yeah, I think it's actually easier than one would think.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, although... I don't think that I can do it now. Like, I don't... What I was feeling yesterday was the opposite. Like, if I was in that situation, I wouldn't know what to do. I felt like I would go insane because I wouldn't actually be able to. But maybe that's because instinctively I know that leaving the body isn't the way to go. Right? Because I used to be very good at it. I used to do astral projection all the time.
Yeah.
Or whatever it was. I mean, I had these experiences of, while conscious, although I would enter into a different state of consciousness, so it was kind of like falling asleep. It was when my body became so relaxed that it felt like something came unstuck, and I became, like, my experience of my body became totally different, and like energized, and then I would experience myself like I had the sensations of actually moving out of my body and moving above my body, like lifting up in space.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a weird combination of moving incredibly fast while at the same time not moving very much. So I mean, if I'd been moving as fast as it felt like I was moving, I would have been on the moon within a few minutes, you know. But I was at the same time with this feeling of great velocity, I was also aware that I was just moving a very small distance, just a few inches above my body. But everything was intensified in terms of sensations and sensory, like sound and motion. Everything was heightened to an extreme degree.
Yeah, I've never really had any experiences with that, but have had somewhat similar experiences that seem to occur only in dreams, where I feel as though I'm floating above the covers, but I'm never sure if that's just part of the dream. Am I really doing it? But it always feels real when it happens. In fact, it happened a few days ago where I was laying on my right side, and I really needed to lay on my left side, and I kept trying and trying and trying, and I finally got up and laid to my left side. But as I rolled over to my left side, and I don't know if this was a dream or what, I realized I was already laying on my left side, and it was like part of me somehow had split out and was laying on the right side, just the top half of my body, and the top half rolled to the left and went back inside where the body actually was laying. And it felt as though I was partially awake, and it actually happened, because I felt a strange feeling of like coming into my body. But I don't know if that was, you know, it could be a lot of different things, but that's about as close as I can get to any experience like that.
I clearly was out of my body, and I felt like I was above my body, but I don't recall actually looking down to see myself.
Well, still, it's remarkable to... while you're actually awake and standing there.
And it was a conscious decision, too, and it happened within seconds of me coming up with the idea and deciding to go ahead and do it. It was
But why would you decide to do something that you didn't know that you could do?
I guess I felt like I knew how to do it.
Yeah, I guess so.
Now my question is, because my question that I have for myself is, because afterwards I had this terrible headache and I was physically like sick for a few hours afterwards. What I'm not sure about is whether it was the damage that I did to myself while I was out of my body, or whether it was the process itself that was damaging.
What's the difference?
Well, one is that it's the actual... There's a difference, I think.
It seems quite a subtle difference.
One is that I did damage to myself while I was out of my body, and the other one is that I did damage to myself through going out of my body, like that process.
Yeah, it caused stress on the system or something. Well, but you might be assuming too much by putting it in such terms as that damage was done, much less that you did damage. You could see it as you disconnected from your body, and so it took you a while to get back into your body, and the feeling of your body's discomfort was just a natural necessary part of getting back into your body.
Hold on one second.
Well, I was thinking just today that I guess, you know, present company, we're all pretty much in agreement in terms of our disdain for transhumanism and even, you know, space colonization plans and all of that. So it almost behooves me, I think, at some point to get somebody to talk to somebody who's actually in favor of these ideas and supporting them.
Mm. You know, I sometimes I wonder if sometimes I feel like maybe I'm just clinging to an outdated, you know, model of humanity and just can't get with the program.
I have the same thoughts. What about you, Phil?
Yeah, sometimes I wonder, but it just doesn't seem feasible to me from a practical standpoint. They're always very positive about, oh yeah, eventually we're just going to go into space and live. It's like, I don't know about that. I'm not sure if we could survive long enough to develop the technology far enough to actually move into space.
Well, that's kind of why they go hand in hand, isn't it? Transhumanism and life extension.
Life extension, yeah. Space. And, you know, the faster we make it impossible to live on Earth, the more we'll be forced to go out there, kind of thing. So, you know, it's like, well, then who gives a shit about the Earth? We'll just go out in space, kind of thing. You know, we could live on the fucking moon or where, I don't know,
well,
the plan is.
Yeah. I mean, I have to question things, or I have to question this whole idea of it being impossible to live on Earth, because I know that is part of the drive now. The so-called environmental crisis is definitely, and certainly in Strieber's book, literally speaking, the key specifically, it's kind of a given that there's too many people on the planet, that the planet can't support us, therefore we have to move out into space. So that sort of rings alarm bells for me, having already in the past few years began to suspect that the environmental crisis was being exaggerated, was being amped up for social political reasons, this kind of adds an even more compelling element to suspect that, or reason to suspect that fact, and or that possibility. And living as I do in British Columbia, and trying to keep to, you know, one of my basic principles of living, which is, you know, don't base anything on, or base my opinions on what I can see and touch and taste and smell. There is no population crisis here. There is no environmental crisis. There's an economic one, for sure. But there's no sense that the planet can't support the species here. On the contrary, there's a sense that the species doesn't know how to survive in the environment, but the environment's right here.
Yeah, I never accepted the overpopulation argument. You know, and the other thing that transhumanism supposedly solves is the problem of death, which I also don't. I just disagree. I don't think it's a problem.
Well, it's a problem for if you've got plans, I suppose. If you want to plan for the next 200 years, then death is, you know, presents an obstacle to be overcome. But then why would you? I mean, it does seem to be fundamental. If you don't accept death, then death becomes a problem, and therefore you look for the solution. I suppose one of the arguments is maybe Tim Leary's, or I don't know who, back in those early days of life extension, intelligence increase, all that stuff, is that we need longer to mature. Which is kind of debatable. I mean, it's like people don't necessarily become more mature or more intelligent as they get older anyway, it seems.
Right.
Yeah, was it going to be 100 years of senility at the end? Yeah, I'd rather be sharper and better in my however many years than extend those years without any idea of whether they'll be good years or not.
Well, this came out with Doug recently, and I think it was the first week, and he talked about, he just brought it up spontaneously because he hadn't read far enough to know that I was getting into transhumanism, although that is in the title, but he was saying that he talked about Alex Gray. I don't know if you know this guy, but Alex Gray is a transhumanist. He's married to a woman who's, I think, 20 years older than him, so you can see how he's got an emotional stake in this matter. He's one of those people who's prophesying and attempting to realize or fulfill the prophecy that, you know, we can live long enough to inherit the technology that will allow us to live longer and so on until we get to live forever. But Doug's point of view, at least the one he put forward, was kind of not so much death, but just physical infirmity as something that if it could be fixed, then it should be fixed by whatever means, you know, necessary. And my counter-argument was that interfering with the process of the body, the natural processes of the body, was kind of a slippery slope, I felt, because a lot of the time our body's letting us know what's wrong in the psyche. So if we can just override that, then we might live longer and be physically fitter, but we definitely wouldn't be developing at a spiritual level.
Just to correct you, though, you meant Aubrey de Grey, not Alex Grey. That's the psychedelic artist.
Okay, thanks for that. In case we go on the air with this. Oh, so you know him then?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that guy.
Well, it's we're on topic anyway, because chapter 4 is about Kurzweil.
Yeah.
Had you heard of Kurzweil before this, Phil?
I don't believe so.
I think it's pronounced Kurzweil.
Okay, there you go again.
No. He's a school teacher.
Nitpick.
Making yourself indispensable.
What did somebody say? School teacher?
Yeah.
He says a school teacher.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That.
Correcting the grammar and spelling.
No, that's good. Especially if Ray is listening. And, it's Strieber, not Striver. Phil already knows that, but...
Okay.
He's decided to...
But it's the same rule. It's the second... Anytime you have the EI, it's always the second letter that you pronounce.
Right. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
I always just went by...
Einstein.
Before E, except after C.
That's a different rule.
Yeah. Anyway, Kurzweil, then. Or Kurzweil. Colonel Kurzweil. I'd never heard of him either. He came up. Yeah, go ahead.
He's a really big figure.
Yeah, he is. He's huge. In those circles that are... Indeed. Interested in the subject, and I mean, I've had a long-standing resistance to transhumanism. To bring it back to the original point, it's like, you know, I'm just dinosaurs revealing our stuck in the mudness.
Okay,
do you need to take that call?
No, I got it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, quite a strong emotional reaction. So I have a friend, Mike LeBert, with whom I did the God Games, and he talks about it sometimes, and he basically embraces the idea of some sort of technologically assisted evolution. And, we would fight over it. I just always had this, and it's, I guess it's the whole Matrix thing. I've just always had this visceral sense that technology is being used to create this trap for us, this kind of consciousness snare. Where I got that idea from, I can't actually say. It was well before I saw the Matrix.
Well, the whole idea that... technology is the sort of McLuhan idea that it's an extension of our senses and our body. And then you can go from that. It's pretty easy to see how tools, they come at a price. With each tool that you use, you then lose the ability to, you become dependent on the tool, and you become... disempowered. You know, you're empowered as long as you have the tool. But then, you know, if you have a calculator and now the calculator breaks and you don't know how to divide, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty simple thing, I think.
Yeah. It might be too simple for these guys. They might just laugh at such old arguments. I don't know. I mean, I imagine they would, one way or another, they would want to dismiss them. But that was my argument in Matrix Warrior, my kind of description of, like, I used the metaphor of the heater, and that, without a heater, if we have to survive in cold climate, we have to find some way. I mean, either we have to figure a way to build a fire or create shelter, and or we have to generate internal heat somehow, which is theoretically and perhaps, you know, realistically possible to generate our own internal heat. People can do it. So, and of course, yeah, if we have heaters, then those capacities, entropy, they shut down.
Indeed.
So that, and a more recent, obvious, well, popular example is TVs and the idea of movies that they've kind of stripped us of our power to imagine. Because we have technology to do it for us. Mm-hmm. But I think the counter argument can be made as well, can't it? That we like the abacus or even the calculator, but more the abacus really is more like obviously a training tool where, that we can learn how to do something by using the technology, and then And then we transcend the technology, then we shed the skin of the technology, and I think that is, I'm definitely not a Luddite. I mean, I use all this technology, and it goes without saying, and I appreciate it, and I love it. But that's my feeling about the correct use of technology, or the correct appliance, or the end result of technology is that we, like you know, training wheels, we at a certain point we forsake the technology because we no longer need it. Transhumanism would seem to be the opposite of that, because it actually is, instead of using technology or allowing technology to develop inner or even outer resources that the technology represents, and then casting off the technology, it wants to bring about a fusion between the organic and the technological, so that we become totally dependent on it, but we don't ever have to feel dependent on it because we've been symbiotically fused with it.
Yeah, and the line has been erased. I mean, I think that's the danger in my mind. It's, I don't have a problem using technology, but I just have a instinctive sort of gut-turning reaction to the idea of fusing with it, so that there's no ability to put it down.
Well, one counter argument would be, well, what about prosthetic limbs and stuff? Like, where do we draw the line, and it being healthy and natural and positive, and it being not, or even spectacles, you know? Or eyes for a blind person. Right. At the moment,
it just reminded me of the $6 million man. when I was a kid, you know, we can rebuild better, stronger, faster.
Yeah, I grew up on that show.
Yeah. So you know, there is the prosthetics, but since you can make them better, stronger, and faster, why not? And what's you know, it is a difficult in that case, it seems hard to argue that you would prevent him from being better and stronger and faster. Who would do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, without falling back on sort of Jehovah's Witness line of argument, which is, yeah, it's, if it's God's will that you lose a limb or that you're blind, you don't want to interfere with that. I mean, that's as extreme as the other extreme, but it does seem kind of essentially that is the kind of argument, isn't it, really, essentially?
Yeah, I guess that there is something sacred about the body as it is.
I think the basic question, maybe, and this is Hal, I used audio footage from Hal in our last conversation, but in the Matrix again, the possibility and all the fear that technology is going to develop a will of its own and actually take us over in some way, or destroy us or both. Like, how real is that possibility?
I don't know that that's literally real. It's a possibility, but that's not so much my concern as the idea that our purpose gets lost in maintaining the machines.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes our that becomes so, you know, almost like a bureaucratic sort of system gets put into place where the maintenance of the machine becomes
that would
super
not be to say that would be getting taken over by the machines in a sense. Yeah, and that I don't know about you guys, but I see the evidence of that all the time. And every time I get into some trouble on the internet and my credit card doesn't get accepted, doesn't matter how many human beings I speak to, they can't do anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, in many respects, we're already in that state.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, in a way, people are already taken over. I mean, people mention cell phones all the time, iPhones, smartphones. I mean, people sit there poking at their phone at work all day long, everybody in a cubicle, sometimes even me, you know? Because not only is it addictive, but it creates more things you have to check. Oh, I got to check my Facebook mail. I got to check my Yahoo mail. I got to check my Gmail. I got to check this mail. All these fucking things to check. All these stupid things to do. And it's like 2 hours later, you're still poking buttons, and you're waiting for things to load. And it's like, I don't even want this in my fucking life anymore, kind of thing. And it's already, it's like, well, that's kind of a taking over. It's not, you know, Colossus the Forbin Project, if you remember that film, or, you know, any of those other movie, you know, horror stories about what could happen if technology took over. It doesn't have to take over overtly and have, you know, even be conscious and have, you know, some sort of voice programmed into it and, you know, tell us you will obey or be like the Borg or anything like that. We're already Borg, you know?
Yeah.
Fucking iPhones. Those are things attached to everybody's hands, you know?
Yeah, I think that's very much how it works, how it encroaches on us.
And to what benefit? You know, people would say, oh, you can do all kinds of things with this phone. It's like, no, you can't really. Nothing really interesting. Nothing really important. Play stupid games, maybe. You know, text bullshit messages back with another idiot, you know?
I think, yeah, it's good to bring sort of very specific examples. You can see the microcosm of and I mean, this is the thing that everybody's saying and to some extent experiencing, that the internet and texting and all the rest of it is bringing us close together because we're able to connect, you know, anywhere, anytime, to anyone, anywhere, anytime. So this whole interconnectedness is becoming more and more real. But at the same time, people are becoming less connected, actually, in the flesh and blood realm.
Yeah.
So
the real world.
Yeah, well, away from keyboard is what the geeks call it, AFK world. Because you know, they argue that it is the real world, just as much the real world through the computer, which I agree with. It's a real connection that we're having now, but it's not flesh and blood. But there's something about the medium is the message and all that is disconnecting. So the way that people connect through this technology is somehow disconnected. And that's, there's this thing I just got off my bookshelf from Morris Berman, which I think puts it very well. He's actually citing someone else. This is in Morris Berman's A Question of Values, and he writes that, he's citing The Lonely American, this book, that it's the small everyday choices people make about how they use technology that has a cumulative effect. Little, in quotes, decisions such as whether to interrupt a conversation with a friend in order to take a cell phone call. Very rude behavior when you think about it. They are powerful, they write, because they are cumulative and because they fuel a vicious cycle, namely the cycle of distancing, of disengagement, not to mention of demonstrating one's importance. The connection between this and Iraq is not as far-fetched as it might initially appear. He says the truth is that macroaggression is not really possible without a cultural basis of microaggression.
Yeah, and then you have, you know, a lot of people have come, I guess it's a common practice now where when people go to lunch, they put their phones in a pile or something, and the first person to check their phone has to pay the bill.
Yeah. How's that? Counteract that. So, yeah, I was thinking that that's kind of a microcosmic example of how the technology is tricking us into thinking we're getting something, but we're actually losing something.
Yeah,
because it's back to trauma. it's much safer, more comfortable to connect to people in a disconnected way. I mean, we feel disconnected anyway. It's really hard for most of us to connect in a way that is intimate, soulful, that allows, you know, to be vulnerable and to be exposed and to really tune into another person. All of that is uncomfortable. It's threatening. So to be able to do it through text and all the rest of it, that's a safe way to do it on the one hand, but also it's a way to keep people at a distance when we are with other people. Like, I appreciate being, you know, Asperger and myself and having a difficult time, very difficult time with just everyday social interaction. I appreciate the fact that when I'm in the public now, just about everybody has got their head down in some piece of technology or other, or they've got earplugs in, so I don't have to go, how you doing, all right? You know, I don't have to do any of that stuff anymore. Because it's like nobody's paying attention to anybody. So, as I say, I don't lament that, because personally it makes passage easier through the Matrix realm, but at the same time I see that this is an evidence, this is sort of an indication of how people are kind of gratefully adopting the technology and adapting to it as a way to become more and more enclosed in their little shells, their pods.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen pictures on the internet where you'll see a group of a dozen people walking down the street and they're all looking at their smartphone, and it says something about, you know, you were waiting for the zombie apocalypse, or it's arrived.
How much of your project is motivated by your dad, his early death, and your yearning for him?
My father's disease definitely impressed upon me our mortality and the grave limitations of our biology, because he got sick when I was 15, he died when I was 22. And I also felt it was a cloud in my own future, because I felt I probably inherited his genetic disposition. That became clear in my 30s when I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. So then I actually sat down, okay, I'm going to approach this as a scientist and as an engineer and gather all the information that's known. And clinical practice does not necessarily reflect all of the information we have. And I came up with my own program, and so that we really do have the means, at least in some cases, and fortunately in mine, to overcome our genetic disposition with our own knowledge and ideas. And the knowledge we have is growing, and we have this whole field of biotechnology where we're gaining the means to reprogram our biology, just the way we reprogram our cell phones. But I'm still walking around with outdated software that evolved thousands of years ago.
Do you think you can bring back your father in a way that he would have continuity of consciousness?
I've got, in fact, hundreds of boxes of documents and recordings and movies and photographs, and I'm in the process of digitizing all that. And actually a very good way to express all of this documentation of my father, who's a musician. I have all of his music, I have all of his letters, I have movies and other artifacts, would be to create an avatar that an AI would create that would be as much like my father as possible, given the information we have about him, and including possibly his DNA. That person would be very much like my father, and you could argue that he would be more like my father than my father would be. And he would pass a Frederick Kurzweil Turing test with me as the judge, or anyone else who knew him. And in my view, if an entity passes a Turing test for being human, let alone a specific person, that person is conscious. All the clouds turn to words, all the words float in sequence, no one knows what they another question. Okay, this avatar of your father will be a conscious person and will convince you that it's your father based on your faded memories of him. But that doesn't mean it's actually his consciousness. It doesn't have his identity, and that may be true. These are philosophical issues which you can't really resolve scientifically.
Joe was here the other day, and he was Indian Joe, the gold prospector, and he was talking about how everyone he knew, younger people, was that they're all into gaming now. They're all game players. And he was like, what is that? What are they doing? And they're just sitting on the computer playing games all day. And he didn't understand. Like, he was trying to figure out why they actually did that. But then he went on a different tangent, and he was talking about what's going on locally in Hope, and how their small clique with their country club are basically siphoning off all the wealth while everyone else gets poorer and poorer, and they've got their own little thing, and they're pulling the strings for the local political decisions and all the rest of it. It wasn't getting into conspiracy. He was just doing about what he sees and experiences, and how it's harder and harder to do anything that's outside of the kind of not just rules but the lines that have been laid down, like walk don't walk lines. You were not literally in Hope because we don't have flash pedestrian lights, but you've got to follow all the different marks that have been laid down in order to be considered an acceptable component within the machine of society. And his example was recently this guy started an ice cream business, his own, with a van, and within a day, I think, he was selling ice cream outside of school. He'd been accused of being a paedophile and a drug dealer, and the police were called, and the whole thing just snowballed, and he's still selling ice cream, but the police are on the corners watching him. And it's just like, apparently this is what it's like here in Hope, is that if anyone actually does something that's new or different, that they're immediately regarded with suspicion, and as often as not shut down or chased out of town. Because, so I said, well, no wonder these kids are just playing their computer games, because what else is there, the actual social system doesn't leave any freedom or opportunity for them. So naturally they're going to want to retreat into these fantasy realms where they can be sword-wielding superheroes or dragon slayers or whatever else it is. It seems like it's a natural compensation for that.
I mean, somebody pointed out to me that there's a Blackwater video game.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that just fucking blew my mind.
So that would be like what, training to be a mercenary kind of thing?
Yeah. And then I think it even says something about how on the cover maybe or something, like, this is not a training. This is for entertainment purposes only.
Well, it does seem like we're being set up, I have to say. Because you've got the machine on the outside, as in the social structures, which are just making it harder and harder to really just develop or follow your own inner sense of where you want to go, what you want to do, being more and more restricted and directed and terrorized and all the rest, surveyed in that world, and then they've got this sort of this other world set up for us that we can then escape into and going to want to escape into more and more.
I mean, as far as I understand, it's illegal in most states to collect rainwater from your gutters.
Uh-huh. Because?
I don't know. I have no idea. But I have a lot of friends who are into permaculture and apparently, if you want to do this, if you want to gather the rainwater from the roof of your house and filter it in a 50-gallon drum or something like that, you've got to do it covertly.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're discovered, you could be fined. This is just fucking crazy.
Like the law against drinking milk as well, from unhomogenized milk or unpasteurized.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyone who tries to, do anything that's outside of the system, you're gonna have a tough go.
Yeah, and it's not like these draconian laws are not evident. It's not like some 1984 scenario where you can see the government encroaching on people's freedom. The people themselves are endorsing and supporting these kinds of laws. They may not be choosing them, but parents putting helmets on their kids is one example. But I get this from Joe. He's a guy who can live off the land, so he's a guy who can live without consuming anything, without using any of these environmentally harmful products, any of that stuff. He can live as humans lived like thousands of years ago. Yet he gets grief from people telling him that he's destroying the environment because he moves a boulder, from one place to another, or because he has a fire or whatever. Just whatever he does that's just basic humans have done for thousands of years is perceived by many kind of civilized, politically corrected humans as anti-environment.
Mm. Wow.
So there does seem to be like this, the whole environmental thing has got people worked up into a fervor whereby they are kind of taking on, embodying, endorsing these draconian laws, as part of a supposed environmental consciousness.
Yeah, and it's been going on since, the early 70s, really?
Yeah.
I mean, Earth Day was, I think, 70 or 71. And we know all about Ira Einhorn. It's just another example of taking, what I think is actually a legitimate truth that we may not be destroying the environment, but we are. I don't think there's any question that we're polluting and adding in all sorts of chemicals and pollutants that foreign sort of entities into the environment, chemicals, Monsanto and genetically modified foods.
Well, who knows, right, at this point, Who knows? We were talking last time about the conspiracy to create the illusion of a conspiracy. Well, who knows, what is an example of that? Who knows, like, some of the conspiracies that we've heard about that are destroying the environment or destroying our food, maybe they're made up as part of a larger conspiracy to make us paranoid about our environment and thinking that we need to return to the roots. And it's really, at this point, as I say, all I can do is look around. Ironically, I'm actually looking at a chimney stack now that's pouring smoke into the air. But besides that, the backdrop is, you know, huge mountains and just a vast expanses of unpopulated and, for most people, uninhabitable, but for Joe, quite inhabitable terrain. So, okay, I mean, that's, you guys will look around, you'll see something different. But I think that's, in the end, that's all we can base it on. I mean, not exclusively, because we refer to some extent to what we can learn, but it really is very hard, I think, to determine what the state of the planet is. It's like a cell trying to figure out if the body's healthy. It's not really the cell's job, is it?
Well, I can see your point. I'm not sure where to go from there, but I just, you know, when the water supply is so polluted that you can't drink it, there's a problem.
There is a problem. I don't think any of us would argue it was a problem. It's just figuring out what it is. What do you think the problem?
Corporations are quiet. They're pouring toxic waste into the water supply, and they don't give a fuck.
Well, not giving a fuck might be a problem. I think I might be with you on that.
So it doesn't have to be a conspiracy on that level. I mean, yeah, sure, there are people that are saying that the chemtrails or whatever are aluminum and or there's heavy metals in there, and then the Monsanto seeds are, you know, aluminum resistant, and they'll be the only seeds that can survive once the planet has been aluminized. But whether or not that's true, I don't know. But, I mean, I don't think Monsanto is, I've never heard anyone defend Monsanto.
No, sure, I even read an article about their satanic modification plan once. But I just would say, I mean, I don't really know enough about biology and organisms and all the rest of it to know whether humans can really interfere with the natural order of things. Like, can this bootstrap theory, isn't it?
But they've got seeds that are suicide. You know, they don't...
Suicide gene. I know all about that, but okay. How do we know? I mean, we don't know that they just won't revert to their natural state after a few generations or less. We don't really know, do we? I mean, the Earth is intelligent. Nature is intelligent, more intelligent than we are, because we're part of it. So, I don't know. I mean, this is where transhumanism again becomes even more interesting, because you can make this an argument against transhumanism, you also make it an argument for transhumanism, is that we are part of nature, so everything we do is part of nature. So if nature is creating, you know, nanotechnological, digital versions of ourselves, then that is natural, it's a natural extension.
Right, are we just sort of inorganic bigots?
Right, yeah.
Do we have this organic bias?
Well, that was my point that you contended with so fiercely a couple of weeks ago about matter being a machine. Well, it wasn't my point, but that was part of what I was getting at, was I don't know this sort of inherent suspicion I have of machines and this inherent sense that machines are soulless. I don't know, you know, how much that's just an emotional position due to, you know, any other kind of emotional position, as in I've got my, I'm stuck in my ways about that. I don't know. Like, you know, one of the things I've looked into and was actually getting ready to write about before I got hijacked by Mother Stranglers and Whitley's game was the ways in which this technology, TVs, internet computers, has contributed to the rise in autism.
Yeah.
So it was Aspergerans who designed the internet largely, and it's autists who are most benefiting from it in a very specific way, because autists who are actually unable to communicate socially now have a medium by which to do so. But, I mean, that's actually surface compared to what has also been speculated, which is that because of this technology being introduced into our society, it has altered the way in which we have developed over the generations and the ways in which children are growing up, and that has increased the amount of autism in the Western society.
That we've sort of gone beyond genetic evolution into where cultural
it's called epigenetics. So, in a way, it's always been. I mean, epigenetics is just to do with nature and nurture being one thing, not either or. It's just one field that we're evolving in or developing in. It's not just internal nature versus external culture. It's all both part of the same process. So, but yeah, the more that we develop technology, it's exponential, isn't it? It's just the idea behind artificial intelligence in general. Sort of transhumanist visions is that if we can design a technology that can then design technology that can then it can evolve exponentially. So to some extent that's happening, isn't it? We have built machines that can build machines.
Sure, there's these 3D printers that can create another 3D printer. And self-replicate in a sense.
Yeah. I was thinking, I hadn't heard about that, so that's generational, like creation. As you say, generational. I was thinking also, specifically in terms of creating software microchips and stuff, we're able to create smaller and smaller microchips because machines are doing it for us, of course. Initially it was to have to be done by hand.
Mm-hmm.
I found out recently that the writing press evolved out of the wine press.
Oh, wow. That's the origin of the term then, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a term for this. I can't quote it, but it's to do with when evolution sort of, there's a surprising branch off. So the example that I got was that logic, there's a theory that logic was initially developed or came about as a way to win arguments, and then it only sort of the branched off into what we now think of it as a way to get to the truth. I guess some people might argue it was the other way around, but I kind of like that.
No, I think that's right. It came out, I think it was born out of rhetoric, or, the sophists, right? That their only goal was to win the argument, not to find the truth.
Interesting. Could be a conversation in itself. I'll just finish the point anyway first, which was that's as an example of some technology or some methodology comes into being, and then another use for it just naturally develops out of that, which may be very different and unexpected. And so apparently this happens. Oh, I know the example. The first one was feathers, that dinosaurs developed feathers I forget what it was for now, but it definitely wasn't to fly with, and then that surprisingly sort of branched off into birds.
Regulate body temperature or something like that?
Yeah, warm. Keep warm, Polly. So, yeah, and this may be what's happening with... Presumably, all this technology we're creating must be for something in terms of the larger picture, because everything serves to further, I think, potentially, anyway. So, one of the things about Kurzweil and the transhumanist that, my opinion, anyway, is that they sort of make their own case against themselves, because what they're proposing is so inherently absurd. It's based on this fallacy that becomes magnified the more I hear, anyway, about their visions and their plans. So when they're talking about extending individual life into infinity, into other worlds and, you know, thousands or millions of years into the future, that's a grand vision, and at the center of it is this basic idea that what we are as human individuals can be translated into a digital form. So, I don't know. I mean, either you believe that or you don't, I suppose. But to me, it's a rank absurdity.
But wait a minute, where's the fallacy?
That who you are can somehow be replicated in a digital form, and that will be you. That will actually be, that the copy will be equivalent to the original.
Yeah, I don't I don't buy it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like, I can't, I don't know. I mean, these people are smart people, right, apparently. Like, technologically, they're intelligent, they create things, they invent stuff, they seem to know more than we do about a lot of stuff. Is it just that they're atheists and so they don't believe in the soul? I don't think so. It's not just that. I can't even comprehend how a person could think that they could actually resurrect their father by collecting as much data about that person and memories and memorabilia and down putting it all into a computer and creating a cyborg, and that would be your father. I don't get it, you know?
Yeah, Phil, what do you think?
Well, I read that part, and a lot of times it just seems like they're getting off on the idea, the possibility, that they could put all these technologies and possibilities together and say, well, we could do it this way. And then they get off on that, and it's, again, more play acting and pretending, and it sounds really cool and neat, and they'd like to actually do that as a science experiment. Do they really and truly believe that that would be their father, that would resurrect their father somehow? I don't think so. And, you know, these type of people, if they are probably autists themselves in some sense, are just getting off on that stream of ideas, that chain of thoughts. And, you know, they will say it till they're blue in their face, and maybe that will be their position till the day that they die. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're really 100% committed to it. It's just they're really excited by it, you know, that thought. So, you know, I think they're just getting off on an idea more than anything.
I think it's serving some purpose for them.
Yeah. Of course.
If they had a, let's say, a troubled relationship with their father, and then they put forth these ideas of a way that they could resurrect him, now they completely dominate him, and they've given birth to him somehow. Now they control him, and they've completely eliminated whatever influence that he's had, negative, positive, whatever, over their lives.
Right.
So it's probably, you know, like so many of these people, completely rational, you know, completely, you know, scientific, and 100% human also, and fallible and flawed, and, you know, the same assholes that the rest of us are, you know, so the same problems. and they're not above it, not one fucking bit, you know?
So it's back to the creating of a fiction, a story that you can invest in and believe in and get lost in, to the point that you don't have to deal with those father issues or whatever else it is, your ailing health or your mortality, because mm-hmm. you've created this narrative in which all of that's been solved.
Right.
Or not yet, but it will be.
It will.
We're on the way.
Yeah, we're on the way, and it's always just right around that next corner. Just keep going, keep going, keep going. Which is why I don't really buy any of them, because I don't see them getting anywhere.
So then, when Keith was, you were suggesting that there's something behind, and well, you're saying something in it for them, and that goes without saying, but it may be that there's something in it for others as well, that if people can be made to believe in these possibilities, then they're also going to get excited, they're also going to get swept away with fervor for these new technologies.
In the fiction of the technology.
Then they're going to support
possibilities. Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to profit from it one way or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what we're at now is we're in a system that is desperately in need of some sort of regeneration. Otherwise, it's heading for a massive collapse. The economic system, the capitalist system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I mean, if people are feeling more and more that the things that they're being sold are not really worth buying, I'm not sure how to finish this thought, but because it seems to be many multi-layered, because on the one hand you've got one of the reasons that the capitalist system is being questioned is that it's destroying the environment. That's become a meme now.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're getting technologies that are being put forward as a way to solve the problem of the collapsing environment while maintaining the capitalist structures. So space travel, for example, is a way to alleviate the situation on the planet without actually having to dismantle any of those capitalist structures. And maybe the same is true in a different way of these transhumanist technologies as well. Like if we can be reduced to software, that's why we won't be consuming any fuel. There'll be no carbon footprint once we're digitalized.
I'm Ray Kurzweil. I'm an inventor, author, and futurist.
21st century.
I'm Ray Kurzweil. I'm an inventor, author, and futurist. Well, we're going to become increasingly non-biological to the point where the non-biological part predominates and the biological part is not that important anymore. Well, we're going to become increasingly non-biological. The biological part is not that important anymore. I'm Ray Kurzweil, I'm an inventor, author, and futurist. In fact, the non-biological part, the machine part, will be so powerful it can completely model and understand the biological part. So even if that biological part went away, it wouldn't make any difference because the non-biological part already understood it completely.
Correct.
We'll also have non-biological bodies. We can create bodies with nanotechnology. We can create virtual bodies and virtual reality. The virtual reality will be as realistic as real reality. The virtual bodies will be as detailed and convincing as real bodies. If we do need a body, our intelligence is directed towards a body, but it doesn't have to be this frail biological body that's subject to all kinds of failure modes. Well, I think we'll have a choice of bodies. And it can be as realistic as real reality, and the environment can be as realistic as real reality. So we'll be routinely able to change our bodies very quickly, as well as our environments. Well, I think we'll have a choice of bodies. Self-organizing swarms of nanobots that link themselves up into a virtual body. Self-organizing swarms of nanobots that link themselves up into a virtual body. In addition to radical life extension, we're going to have radical life expansion. We're going to have millions of virtual environments to explore. We'll be thinking grander, deeper, more hierarchical thoughts than ever before. If we had radical life extension only, we would get profoundly bored. We'd have a profound existential ennui, running out of things to do and new ideas. But that's not what's going to happen. So we're not going to get bored. If that weren't the case, then I think, you know, living for hundreds, thousands of years would be a profound philosophical nightmare. But instead, we're headed for radical life expansion. So we're not going to get bored. So we're not going to get bored.